This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Communicated a warning that unless we stop abusing their environment, that they will eliminate mankind from it completely.
Killer bees invade the U.S., and it's up to John Saxon to save every one of us in 1978's The Bees. That's just one of two films we'll be discussing on this edition of Go Home in a Box here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. This is the leftover turkey edition, I guess, if you will, of Go Home in the Box. I am Chris Jordan of RetroMovieNerd.com. And with me, as always, is the Ayatollah of Pop Cultura, Joe LaPuma.
Thank you for that, Chris. You can find me at Razor Candy at Razor-Candy.com.
Excellent. Yes, you can. And with that, we are going to talk about The Bees in the first half of the show, and then we'll be discussing a suitable follow-up in the second half of the show. But first, we've got some new releases to discuss this week, as always, as we traipse on over to the new release section. These are new Blu-ray and DVD retro releases for release date, November 28th. I guess we'll kick it off with probably the biggest one, Joel, from Shout Factory, or Scream Factory. 1990's Misery. We have a collector's edition Blu-ray coming out this week.
Yeah, I mean, this one is surprisingly underreported in certain circles. I mean, it's such a huge film, you'd expect more attention, especially with our current vogue for Stephen King-related properties.
Yeah.
And, you know, great. I'm sure Scream would have been interested in doing this anyway. It's a classic movie. It's not my favorite Stephen King, but it's just a nice, tight little thriller with some great performances.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had Kathy Bates get nominated for an Oscar for this role. I can't remember. Did she win?
I don't believe she won. I think they did. They figured they had done their duty for horror films with Silence of the Lambs, and that was about all horror films were getting at the Oscars for the next lifetime.
Yeah, and also a great James Caan performance, probably one of my more favorite James Caan performances, outside of his role in Elf.
Yeah. That classic James Caan picture.
Exactly. Misery, collector's edition Blu-ray out from Scream Factory this week. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, of course, we've got some really good Rob Reiner direction, and the screenplay was done by William Goldman, so we've got a lot of Princess Bride connections somehow. I'd be remiss in not mentioning Richard Farnsworth's performance as the sheriff. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Really wonderful actor. I mean, most people know him from this and The Straight Story.
Yeah, just a down-home guy. Yeah, he was the guy that you called on if you needed an old grizzled veteran who's on the verge of retirement or whatever it is he's doing. But Richard Farnsworth was one of the more underrated character actors in his day.
And a stuntman as well. And I am going to have to apologize to the Academy Awards because Kathy did win.
She did win, that's right. Best Supporting Actress, right?
No, best lead actress.
Oh, man.
Good for the Academy Awards.
All right. Well, not bad. Not bad. So we've got an Oscar winner to talk about this week. Awesome.
My cynicism was unfounded.
But we've got a Blue Underground release this week, Joel, from 1974. It's a movie probably best known as Death Dream, but it's got other titles, including Dead of Night. And this is some classic 70s drive-in fare about a guy who returns home from the war. It's kind of a this is a more of a horror film. Basically, what do we got? We got a mother praying that her son returns home from the war after he's already died, and he shows up with this weird smiley grin on his face. That's got to be the creepiest shots in the whole movie. Is him standing behind the door, and he's got that really creepy look on his face, dude. I mean, yeah, that was some scary shit.
Yeah, it's a great, effective, abrasive little creepy film. And Blue Underground, you know, did a DVD of this years ago, but it's nice to see it get the Blu-ray treatment. And you know, there's a lot of special features, including Bob Clark commentary, you know, Alan Ormsby commentary.
Yep.
A feature on Tom Savini, because Savini did some early effects on this. You know, it's just a great, abrasive, angry little film, like the kind that you get with drive-in fare in the 70s, where it's giving you like a genre film, but at the same time, it's like sneaking in some real commentary through the back door. I mean, it's a film that's angry about Vietnam.
Yes, it's some definitely an anti-Vietnam theme hidden beneath all that horror content, but I caught this on Amazon Prime a few months back. So, and this is Bob Clark, like you said, the director of Black Christmas and A Christmas Story. So he's a very wide-ranging director in terms of tone and atmosphere.
Yeah, and this was in the era before zombies really got codified as one particular Romero style thing, which is not to take anything away from Romero, but like, you know, there was the opportunity to do different things with zombies that I feel like exist to a much lesser extent today, because we know zombies has, you know, the shambling corpses without any like real level of sentience except for a desperate hunger, like, you know, but having this as like a zombie story, I mean, it's obviously a precursor to Joe Dante's Homecoming, the Masters of Horror episode he did.
Yeah,
although that was based on a short story with a similar premise, which I don't know if that was inspired by this, but there feels like a definite through line. I mean, you can even like you could even say this was an inspiration on the late 90s slasher pick Uncle Sam.
Yeah, you could probably draw that line there. You can kind of also compare this to kind of like a Monkey's Paw type story, where more it's
definitely.
Be careful what you wish for sort of deal, you know. Definitely, I think one to check out for sure. We've got a few other releases here, just to touch on, Joel. I see that we've got a new, from Garage House, we got a new Trailer Trauma collection.
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar with the series, this is the fourth installment in the series. It's basically just collections of vintage film trailers. This one is all television spots. Yeah, they've done one. Most of them have not been themed. I think the previous one was specifically 80s, but I think the other ones were just general collections.
Right.
But they're starting to get into sort of loose themes with these, and they find some pretty amazing stuff. They can be a little pricey, because Garage House is such a small distribution company, and I'm sure like putting these together takes at least some. A decent level of work to find and clear all these films. But yeah, if you love old trailers, and what the hell are you doing here if you don't? Like they're wonderful collections.
Absolutely. I know I'm always you know, I keep a running tally of movies I'm watching on Amazon Prime. Screw you, Netflix. Anyway, I always check to see, because sometimes some of these selections, when you, before you stream, they'll include the trailer, and I always try to check the trailer out before I watch the film. So I love old trailers, and I think this is a good idea to collect a bunch of these trailers on one set. Sounds awesome.
Oh yeah, they're really cool collections. I always recommend it.
Yeah. So we've got Kino Lorber's putting out The Woman in Red with Gene Wilder and Kelly LeBrock, and this was a big hit in, I guess it was 1984, 85. The Christa Berg theme song, Lady in Red's from this movie. Huge hit, I remember that. So Woman in Red's out this week. Vinegar Syndrome. They're putting out quite a few this coming week, Joel. We've got, is this the Black Friday that we touched on a few weeks back?
Yeah, we've got they released a number of films for their Black Friday special, which may still be available at the time of the publishing this podcast. We've got Liquid Sky, which I bought sort of sight unseen. I've checked out some trailers and read a lot about it. It's a extremely strange sort of post-punk new wave glam alien film, kind of a gender-bending brother from another planet, I would say.
All right, okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with it, so it actually sounds like I enjoy Brother from Another Planet, so I mean that kind of, you know, has kind of like a cool follow-up there, so I think that's worth checking out.
Yeah, it looks phenomenal. So I ordered that sight unseen. They also released, during some of their big sales, they'll release a couple of limited edition films that they hadn't previously announced. They're a mystery till the sale starts. So this year it was the 1983 regional slasher flick Disconnected, which I believe is kind of almost De Palma-ish, like sisters kind of psychological slasher film from 1983.
Okay.
From the director of Psychos in Love, which I think they've Vinegar has also released at some point, and a number of other films that they've released or looked into, as well as the 1995 Clint Howard Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to the radio earlier today, Joel, in the car, and the radio personality guy came on and mentioned the death of Rance Howard, and he mentioned that Rance Howard is the father of Ron Howard, but unfortunately there was no mention of Clint Howard anywhere.
Ugh.
Just such a disservice to the man. This guy's been in, he's probably worked way more than Ron Howard's worked. And so, I mean, it's just a, you know, Clint Howard, you know, just a disservice not to mention him in a piece like that, because the guy, he's a cult icon.
Yeah, Clint's been, listen, in the choice between Opie and Eagle Bauer, I'll take Eagle Bauer.
Day long.
Oh, yeah. But Ice Cream Man is a fun, for those who haven't seen it, is a fun little mid-90s comedy horror. You know, it's very much along the lines of The Dentist or Dr. Giggles, yeah, or The Vagrant Killer.
It's one of those employment-oriented, you know, horror films.
But surprisingly good. Like, there's a really good cast, although they don't really get much to do. They have a lot of small roles, like David Naughton's here, David Warner, Jan Michael Vincent, Olivia Hussey.
Jan Michael Vincent.
Yeah, Sandal Bergman. Hell of a cast.
Jan Michael's probably on his 15th drug conviction at this point, huh?
I'm actually surprised he showed up to set. But
he found the set.
I would imagine almost all of the budget went to the cast, just getting those people for small roles.
Awesome. So yeah, Ice Cream Man. I love Ice Cream Man. So this is a highlight for me from Vinegar. So quite a few selections this week. Of course, the big ones from Scream Factory, the Misery Collector's Edition, and then Blue Underground with Death Dream, and then the fourth edition of Trailer Trauma from Garage House. Probably the big ones this week you should probably check out.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, I'm always a big supporter of anything Vinegar Syndrome does. They're great guys, and they put out really interesting releases, really strange obscurities. I mean, yeah, I'll report back when I get Liquid Sky and how that was. I'm expecting a really fascinating, weird film.
Yeah. It'll probably end up on this show one day.
Yeah.
It's time to talk about the bees.
I think we need to listen to what the bees have to say before we talk about it.
We need to listen to what the bees have to say. And, of course, that's one of the premises in the film. As we mentioned, from 1978, it's a Mexican film, but it's totally... English language. Don't worry about that. It's not dubbed or subtitled or anything like that. Mainly the premise is about South American bees making their way to the U.S., wreaking all sorts of havoc. One of the things I want to touch on this, just out of the gate, Joel, and there's one thing you've noticed right out of the gate with this, and especially in the early scenes, this is such, there is rampant stereotyping and racism throughout this movie, is there not?
Which is pretty impressive for a Mexican film made by a Mexican director.
Yeah, let's talk about Alfredo Zacharias real quick. Probably the only two notable films he's done, other than, you know, some stuff in his native country of Mexico, was this one, The Bees, and the 1981 film Demonoid. I guess he's got plenty of experience in his own country, but, you know, in terms of this, I guess the tone of his, I haven't seen any of his Mexican work or anything like that, so I can't attest to that, but I'm assuming that, you know, him doing probably a bigger budget film here for American audiences, I'm just curious to wonder if this is a tone, the tone of The Bees, is this something that runs rampant through the rest of, you know, his previous Mexican work?
It's, you know, hard for me to tell without much background. I will say that the most recent film he directed and wrote, which was about 15 years ago or so, was an adaptation of John Steinbeck's The Pearl. I think he may do some more serious stuff in his Mexican only work, or his, you know, work that's mostly for the home market. Of course, his father was a director, Miguel Zacharias, kind of a Mexican Roger Corman, who gave a lot of opportunities to young actors who would become huge stars in Mexican film. So I would imagine a lot of his stuff is probably a little more serious. I have a lot of questions about the making of The Bees, because there's a story that gets repeated by Zacharias that he got the idea from his son buying him a jar of honey at Knox Berry Farm. But at the same time, the film was also co-written by Jack Hill, who was originally going to be the director, but was replaced by the producers before filming began. Probably.
Yeah.
And, you know, it came out the same year as The Swarm, a much bigger budget film by Warner.
Yeah, they were I guess the producers were trying to push this film out to get out there at the same time as The Swarm, but they were forced to delay it until after The Swarm was released.
Well, from what I understand, Warner Brothers offered them a lot of money to
push it back, yeah.
So
if Warner Brothers is throwing you money, then you'd be best advised to take it.
Just take the money, because otherwise you either take Warner Brothers' money or you deal with Warner Brothers' legal team. It seems like a pretty easy choice.
They'll send Yakko and Wacko your way to rub you out.
But so very so it has a very sort of, I don't want to say shady, because I don't think there's anything shady about this production, but a very sort of like a bleak sort of creation to it. I really don't know, like, if they heard about the swarm and were trying to rush it out before that, or what the deal was. So, you know, it is a New World Pictures film. So Corman's always been good at like finding out what the next big film was going to be, and then like getting that one in before like anything.
Yeah, kind of do what the Asylum does now.
But with honestly better, much better quality.
Well, yeah, obviously. Not to say that the Asylum films are any good, because they're not. Yeah. But it's basically the same concept, is try to get your mockbuster out there before the actual thing. So, let's talk about the opening scenes here real quick, so to run down the story. So this story kicks in, of course, with this dire warning of that, you know, killer bees are spreading quickly, rapidly across South America, and of course they show us a handy little map with arrows on it showing the direction that the bees are traveling, and they're traveling north, my friend, to North America after they conquer South America. But the movie starts in South America with Dr. Miller, played by Claudio Brook, who lives on site with his wife Sandra Miller, played by Angel Tompkins. We'll get to everyone in a minute, but the movie starts with a father and son breaking into the facility to steal some honey. And I can't remember the sign on the screen door of where the killer bees are kept. It's in Spanish, obviously, but the kid asks his father what the sign says, and he says, "It means it's lots of honey."
Also,
and he's got his screwdriver trying to break the hinges.
These actors seem remarkably Mexican for an opening scene that we should say is set in Brazil.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, they go into the wrong hut. They go into the killer bee hut and unleash the killer bees, and they're running and screaming for their lives. Lots of aye aye aye, and the little kid, the son, he's just a little boy. He jumps into the river to try and get the bees off his tail, but of course, unfortunately, the young boy drowns. And so the very next day, Dr. Miller and his crew are fixing the broken door, and he's having a nice, lovely breakfast with his wife, and when suddenly some angry villagers show up, complete with flaming torches in broad daylight. And of course, the man returns with the dead body of his son, which he of course blames on the devil bees. Devil bees kill my son.
Which is already bad enough, but I love Claudio explaining, "I know you hate double bee. I need time to turn double bee into good bee."
That's what I wanted to talk about. Is Claudio Brook, Dr. Miller, just. He speaks perfect English, but he reverts to broken English when he's talking to these people. And it's kind of racist and stereotyping, but I can't help but laugh, because it's just so outrageous. It's really not something you would find in a lot of today's films, you know, on occasion maybe, but in the case of this is 1978, and so stuff like this was way more common. And
it was. I mean, even at that late era, I mean, this is probably about the last era where you really got stuff like that before the period of like big message movies about colonialism started happening. Stuff like Gandhi, stuff like the Killing Fields. I mean, but basically what you might term genocide pictures.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminded, like, I watching that scene, I kept thinking of a really like tone deaf version of a lot of like African colonial narratives I've read, stuff like A Grain of Wheat, like, but done from the white perspective, even though this was a Mexican production.
Yeah.
And it's set in Brazil, but it's basically Mexico, and it's just wrong in every direction. It's phenomenal.
It is. So, yeah, he need more time to make B good, or whatever it was he said. The term bad B into good B. But, you know, all hell breaks loose in the villagers. I think there's a woman who throws a rock at Dr. Miller's head and brains him with it. And then
help but yell out rock war after seeing it.
Yeah. So, of course, shit goes down and the villagers end up torching the place. And we've got people on fire running through the place. I enjoy a good scene of man on fire is what I call it. The man on fire scene where, you know, the stunt man is... he's literally on fire, and he's just, like, screaming his head off. And so.
And this scene is going to set a real tone for the film, not of horror, but of complete idiocy and catastrophe. Yeah. Like, every bee attack, every misfortune in this film is exacerbated by the incredibly panicked and stupid reactions of the cast.
Exactly. And, yeah, there's a few of the things to touch on. So, you know, Dr. Miller perishes through a bee attack. The bees kill him. His wife survives. She's ushered out of the place. And his wife, Sandra, played by Angel Tompkins. Now, Angel Tompkins, just looking at her career a little bit. She's been in stuff like The Don Is Dead with Anthony Quinn. She was in Walking Tall Part 2 with Bo Svenson. She was in Murphy's Law with Charles Bronson. Alligator. The Naked Cage.
She is an old hand at the killer animal genre between the bees and between the bees and Alligator.
Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, I probably know her best before aside from the bees from the teacher. Which is like kind of a fascinating, sleazy version of the Graduate.
Yeah. she plays Dr. Miller, now the late Dr. Miller's wife, Sandra, and she survives the torching of the lab and the bee attack, and she makes her way to New York to seek out John Saxon as they need help with this bee. Now, the thing is, I understand that, you know, her husband just died, but there doesn't appear to be any grieving time on her part.
You know, I don't like, she seems, I mean, listen, the undiluted magnetism of John Saxon cannot be dismissed in terms of her lack of grief. I mean, obviously, your husband just died, John Saxon is doing like yoga in a bathrobe. Obviously, you're gonna want to get with that.
Son of a bitch. Yeah, the only thing was missing was John Saxon performing karate on the killer bees.
I was kind of hoping he would perform karate with the bees, like maybe like put some honey on his hands, draw them to his hands, and then. You know, punch some gangsters fists.
It could be kind of like a Last Dragon bit where he could put honey on his hands and his hands start to glow.
Yes!
And he's using the power of the Iron Fist on the bees to decimate them. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. What does happen is Sandra shows up in New York, and I wanna say this is another one of my favorite scenes. She's got this little carrying case with her that contains the bees. And there's some muggers hanging outside the hotel where she's staying, and they follow her in, and they attack her in the elevator, and she runs off, but they open her case containing the bees, and the poor bastards are attacked by bees. And this is another one of my favorite scenes, is a man intentionally throwing himself through window.
There'll be a lot of that.
Yeah, he's running, screaming, with the bees attacking him, and his only option that he has to escape is throwing himself through the lobby door window.
This is admittedly why I always carry at least a wallet full of bees on my person in the city for self-defense, if not a full backpack.
Exactly. Open your backpack, unleash the bees on those... yeah, well, you know, I thought they gentrified the city, but in your case, but I guess maybe there's still a little bit of a death wish in the big city, huh?
You know, you never know. Like, I mean, look at me. I'm rolling deep. I've got all this great shit on me. You know, yeah. custom Nikes. Like, yeah, people get weak sometimes. They see something they want and they mug, and that's when you have bees.
Yeah. So the killer bees fend off the muggers for Ms. Sandra Miller. So she ends up, you know, recollecting herself and seeking out John Saxon. Of course, he's in his hotel room or apartment with a woman at the time. She comes in all disheveled and beat up, and he immediately tells this other chick to go home, and he moves in on Mrs. Miller. So then we meet Dr. Sigmund Hummel, played by the late, great John Carradine, a horror actor from the 30s, from such movies as The Mummy and whatnot. So, Dr. Sigmund Hummel is actually the uncle of Sandra Miller. And I think he spends half this movie talking with his eyes closed. You know, and there's a scene he's sitting on the couch with the two of them in the room with him, and he's got a blanket draped over him, like maybe he's a little cold. He's giving speeches with his eyes closed, and just a kind of a strange performance from John Carradine in this one.
Well, not to be too much of a drag, but apparently he was in fairly bad health when he made this, like to the point losing on jobs because it was hard to insure him for productions. But I will say, him having his eyes closed so often does help increase the effect when he opens his eyes and does that wide eye, like crazy eye thing with his like German accent in this.
Oh yeah, and that's so. I mean, I understand that, you know, he was old and he was, you know, towards the end of his life at this point, but it still makes for some unintentional comedy in this case. And there's a scene in this film where I guess they're videotaping their experiment with the bees, and Sandra or Angel Tompkins is, you know, playfully, you know, hanging around the bees, and she's making faces at the camera and blowing kisses, and John Saxon and John Carradine are standing there watching the video, and they're both saying that she's blowing kisses at them. And I think John Saxon says something about implying incest or something like that. And oh my gosh, it was just the small talk in this film was quite cringeworthy.
I will say, oh yeah, I mean, it's cringeworthy, but that's part of what makes this film so endearing to me. I mean, I love this movie unreservedly, and the weird small talk, like it's just those small moments of these three like goofing around with each other and play like joking with each other. Like occasionally Angel Tompkins will like do it, will like mimic John's German accent at him. Like it's really sort of endearing and charming thing, and the kind and like that kind of like relax off the cuff vibe you don't get in a lot of movies now, even the ones that are like actively trying for like a level of improv to them.
Yeah, and so I mean, it's certainly, you know, with the tone of the film already set, I mean, that's just something to expect, is just the mundane small talk being littered with you know, comedic lines of dialogue such as that. Of course, the man of the hour in this film, of course, is John Saxon, he's appeared in. Of course, we all know John Saxon. He's done a ton of movies. I don't think he ever says no to a role, it shows because he's been in a lot of stinkers, but quite a few movies as well, and I mean, the film he did just before The Bees was Moonshine County Express, and then one of the movies he did after The Bees, Cannibal Apocalypse. He was in Battle Beyond the Stars. What else can we? Prisoners of the Lost Universe. Of course,
are we just naming his Are we naming his unfortunate choices, or are we naming like all?
I was going to say that he's probably a lot of people probably best remember him as, Lieutenant Thompson in A Nightmare on Elm Street,
or Roper from Enter the Dragon. Possibly his role in Argento's Tenebrae. I'm sure a lot of horror fans have seen that. I mean, his cop role in Black Christmas. He's been around. I mean, he takes good roles, takes bad roles, but he's always John Saxon, goddammit.
Yeah, and that's correct. That is correct. You know, this is John Saxon playing John Saxon in The Bees, and just basically, I think he plays it rather tongue in cheek in this place. It's just he gives the speech at the end of the film about needing to listen to the bees, and we need to work with the bees, all that stuff he was talking about. And he did it in his usual, deadpan John Saxon voice without a hint of irony.
No, I love that. He's got that sort of gruff, hairy chested 70s masculinity.
Exactly. And of course, in this movie, of course, he was quite the ladies' man, because he had, one or two women on his arm throughout at any one time in the film. And it's just, I just wanted to see more John Saxon versus the bees, I guess.
Yeah, he came to an understanding with them pretty quickly. I mean, that's the thing. We've got a film here where, in contrast to, say, a lot of 50s sci-fi, even some of the other post-Jaws sci-fi, post-Jaws monster movies, science is not the enemy here. I actually thought that was the most realistic thing in the film, that what's holding up the process of saving the day is bureaucracy and money-grubbing corruption. And it's done in a way where it's not really mustache twirling like you'd get in a lot of films like this. Like, it's just that everyone's so short-sighted and argumentative, and they're trying to talk to like all these UN reps about this issue. And
do you mean the stereotypical UN reps?
Well, stereotypical. This is not the United Nations. This is the United Nations of ethnic stereotypes.
Exactly. The guy from Cuba. But, the guy from Cuba sounded exactly like Al Pacino in Scarface.
Oh my God, he did. Well, and then he's of course complaining that people are trying to find an alternative to use honey as an alternative to sugar, which, by the way, does not seem like economically sustainable. But he's complaining about sugar, and all I can hear in my head is Homer in the Simpsons episode where he gets all the sugar and he's hoarding it, like, and starting to talk like Tony Montana.
Yeah, the sugar gets you power. Yeah, so that was quite awesome. But let's talk about some of the chaos throughout this movie.
Oh my God, the chaos is what keeps me coming back to this.
They used stock footage. I mean, I must have seen this one piece of stock footage several hundred times in my lifetime, of the airplane crashing and burning, the airliner. So we've got bees attacking like helicopters and fighter jets, and we've got these things crashing and burning to the ground, and they're using stock footage.
We've even got bees superimposed over parade stock footage of a parade that Gerald Ford attended after he was president. Like, so with the implication that the bees at some point attacked Gerald Ford.
Yep.
Like, we don't actually see that, of course, because it's just, I don't know how they, how the effects were done, how the they superimposed, like, bees over the stock footage. I don't know if it was, multiple film slides spliced together, or if they painted the actual film slides they were using with.
I couldn't find any information on exactly how they filmed or created these scenes, so I kind of came up empty in my research on that part.
Yeah, I was wondering, and I couldn't find anything myself. Even the there was on the Vinegar Syndrome release, there was an interview with Zacharias, but he didn't say anything about that, which was disappointing.
So, yeah, and unfortunately we didn't see enough parade chaos, in my opinion. I wish we'd seen a float driving down the street at, like, 80 miles an hour, careening left and right, because, you know, knocking people off. That would have been hilarious. Just people flying off of parade floats because it's traveling at, you know, a maximum speed of, like, 50 miles an hour.
Oh, but we did get plenty of other chaos. I mean, whenever something goes wrong in this film, it goes wrong. People, and, you know, I think there's a certain art that goes sort of under-recognized in, like, bigger scale films, working with extras. And I know directors generally, like, they've got people for that. They've got ADs, and they've got grips, and they've got, like, a million people that can help, like, corral all these extras. But, you know, there's some directors who are really phenomenal at, like, having extras that feel naturally a part of the scene. Like, I always think, like, the first thing I always think of are, like, all the crowd scenes in Jaws. And a lot of that is just because they got, like, people from the island, but everyone just sort of fits.
Yeah.
And, like, no one is really distracting. the bees is nothing but distracting extras. There's absolutely no organization to these extras. They're basically just tossed out there, told to run around, look weird, like, look scared, and they just do it in the weirdest ways. There's no one, there clearly was, like, no one looking at the crowd shots, and some of them are of course, like, stock footage. I'm pretty sure there's one running crowd scene that gets superimposed with bees that may be from, like, footage from the 50s or 60s.
Yeah, it's just hilarious to see stuff like that. I mean, absolutely. The highlight of the film for me, of course, is the chaotic scenes. And there's one scene of a guy on a bike or something, and he's in a panic, and he flips over trash cans, and it's alright, sorry about that, Joel. We had a couple of technical issues here, and I blame bees. And
bees are responsible for everything.
They are. But I've cleared the bees, and anyway, I was talking about some of the chaotic scenes in this, and another one was there was a scene with a crooked politician in his apartment, you know, getting attacked by bees, and there's another guy that falls out of, he actually backed himself out his own window, and fell to the ground. Of course, we got the floating dummy. We follow the floating dummy all the way to the ground.
There's no, like, cuts to make this look better or more realistic. It's just straight up, you're fixed, like, the camera is fixed on a dummy, slowly careening to the ground.
Yeah, those arms and legs flailing behind it.
I mean, you know, I think you're giving a little bit of a short shrift to that, the scene where he falls out the window, though. I think the implication is that the bees talk to him and, you know, convinced him of his guilt over, you know, funneling money out of the bee-related science to his own personal accounts, because he had apparently a plot point been stealing money from all these agricultural products for a good long time. And the bees probably convinced him that suicide was the only honorable form of penance. That is the power of the bees.
And he had to listen to the bees.
We all have to listen to the bees.
I wish I had a transcript of the John Saxon speech at the end. You know, when he's talking to the UN.
There are so many moments in this film that are so meme-worthy, and it amazes me that this film has not gotten more attention. Not just on the internet in general. I mean, you'd think after the rise of, you know, the animated film Bee Movie has a meme that other bee-related films would be drawn into that. But,
yeah.
You know, in the horror, like, I am shocked that the horror community has not picked up on this film more than they have.
Well, I know. I mean, that the Swarm still gets some play from time to time on, you know, on cable.
And that film is like longer than Showa.
It is, but you know, but the bees, you know, it doesn't. You're right. It doesn't get any love, and so that's why, you know, a streaming service like Shudder, which has the bees, is a good investment for a lot of people who are into genre films, because you know, they curate stuff just like that, you know, scattered throughout the service, and that's where I caught the bees for the first time, and yeah, it was well worth that $5.
Yeah. And of course, there is a wonderful Vager Syndrome Blu-ray of the bees, which I recommend to anybody. Just anybody.
Yeah. So, yeah, and this will probably lead into something we'll talk about later towards the end of the show, but everyone, I think, needs to at least give the bees a chance, because it's just gloriously awful, and it's just a good time. I mean, it's so bad it's good, and it's a very good time. Wall-to-wall entertainment from beginning to end, there's just something to point at and mock for the most part. You know what I mean? You can enjoy that on the level, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can enjoy it as like a very, like a really strange attempt to do a film with that's bigger than its resources will allow, and you can also enjoy like its, you know, oddly sincere tone. I mean, of course, we've talked about like John Saxon deadpanning everything, and there is like the actors, I have no doubt, know how ridiculous this is, but there is like a really endearing level of sincerity in what they're saying, like, and not just what the bees are saying, which is mostly buzz, but you know what the film was saying. Like, the film is, you know, trying to be a genuine environmental picture. The film is trying to be a genuine, like, you know, picture about not just environmentalism, but about, you know, the ways in which bureaucratic, like, red tape and corruption, like, get in the way of active attempts to improve the world and improve culture through scientific advancement. It's not, for this era of film, like, in terms of, you know, monster movies, in terms of film in general, like, you know, it's oddly progressive and kind of, like, I mean, you know, it's not hard to see a link between this, you know, overtly environmental film and, like, the current controversy, you know, years long controversy over climate change.
Yeah.
and the government and corporate bureaucracy that have held up scientific progress in that, you know, circle. So it's really easy to see a connection between the, like, the bees, for all its goofiness, actually managed to hit on things that would be incredibly relevant, just in a way that's completely batshit.
Yeah, batshit's the word. And of course, there's also the subtextual theme of listen to and talk to the bees, and come to an understanding, and understand that there are synergistic benefits to listening to the bees.
Yeah, there's where we may lose some of the accuracy, but actually not really. I mean, all right, the communication part, yes, but, you know, a widespread bee die-off has actually been one of the biggest concerns of the scientific community in the past decade. Like, because bee pollination is one of the things that keeps an ecosystem going.
Yeah.
But so it's kind of fascinating that this goofy little, like, you know, rush to print film, like, hit on all these things almost by accident.
Yeah, by accident. I think that's the best way to describe that. And of course, you talked about the bee die-off, but we cannot blame that on the presence of John Saxon, fortunately for us.
No, John Saxton, as well as John Carradine, our friend to be.
They're a friend of B.
They turn bad
B into good B. Holy shit. Oh my gosh. Just racism and stereotyping. I don't want to put a positive spin on it, but it was pretty glorious.
You know, it's maybe easy for me to say this, but it loses a bit of its bite when it's a film that's like 40 years old.
So there you have it. The Bees from 1978. Check it out. It's a good time, and it has a message.
It has a message that's both sort of amazingly on purpose and by accident at the same time.
Yeah. Check it out. With that said, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, lab rats accidentally injected with an experimental growth serum eat their way through any human that is stupid enough to stand in their way. We'll be talking about 1989's Nah, Food of the Gods 2, right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling. focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Now, I don't think we need to have any publicity on this unfortunate incident, do you?
All I see is a dead kid without a face.
Lab rats. Injected with an experimental growth serum. Mayhem. Madness. Lot of chewing. Nah, Food of the Gods 2. 1989 horror film. Supposedly, allegedly, the sequel to the original Food of the Gods. In name only, because the two films aren't really related. But this is a Canadian-made film. So we're going to expect a lot of Molson beer cans and some toques.
And I'm always being stereotypical.
Hey, man, that's my home country. I'm allowed. That's like being Jewish and telling Jew jokes. So
you do have C word privileges there. No, I mean, this is obviously very Canadian. There's a lot of Canadian accents on display in Gnaw, Food of the Gods, too.
It is. It's quite awesome. It actually took me back down memory lane. It was a good nostalgic trip back home to Canada. But yeah, the premise basically. Let's roll through the plot real quick. Of course, we start with Dr. Neil Hamilton, our hero, the star of the film, played by Paul Kufos. He gets a call from his mentor, Dr. Travis, she's played by Jackie Burroughs, about a young boy named Bobby. His growth has been treated with an experimental serum, but he's swiftly and unexpectedly grown larger than a full-grown adult. Oh, and he's become a little violent and a little rapscallion. One of the funny things is when Dr. Hamilton shows up at Dr. Travis's place, she takes him up into the boy's room where he's staying, I've never not seen this film before now, and it totally threw me off when I saw this big, giant 10-year-old kid coming into the room and cussing up a storm, telling everyone to get the fuck out of his room in his little 10-year-old voice. His voice never changed, his size did. So,
quite frankly, I have so many questions about this scene, and also I didn't realize at first that he was supposed to be, like, affected in terms of personality, because that seemed like a reasonable reaction for a, like, 10-year-old kid who had just been turned.
He's been given serum, and I guess that would be a normal reaction to anyone who suddenly fucking 8 times taller than they need to be.
Especially, and not only that, you're a 10-year-old kid and you've been given a license to swear as in public as much as you do in private with your friends. Like,
who's going to stop him, right?
Yeah, you not only have a justification because of a situation there. You've got here's the thing. He's probably not stronger. This is like total science nerd pedantry, but like, you know, I'm worried about this kid, not just because of the growth, but like, you're talking about probably about the same bone density, like spread out over like three times the surface area, this kid is going to be brittle. He is not going to be going to be healthy. Like you know, and like this is not a superhero thing. It's not like he, you know, a Marvel movie where like Hank Pym or Scott Lang or whoever can like turn into giant man and like be super strong because Pym particles. This is vaguely trying to be a sci-fi, like some kind of, you know, somewhat grounded science fiction. So yeah, this kid is gonna be like, he shouldn't be standing without like being Mr. Glass at this point.
Yeah, and I wonder, Joel, I wonder how much research was actually done prior to this screenplay being written.
So much.
Screenplay written by Richard Bennett and E. Kim Brewster. Thank you very much. I don't think this is the kind of movie where bone density is really truly thought out. So I guess the deal is that Dr. Travis wants Neil, Dr. Hamilton, to take his serum back and do work on it so he can perfect it. Because obviously the kid's not supposed to be growing at that rate, so she really wants him to help her find a cure to the overgrowth. So he takes the serum back to his lab. He works at a college, or in Canada we call it university. And what we find there, of course, we've got animal rights activists outside protesting the work of Professor Edmund Delhurst, played by Colin Fox. He claims he's trying to find a cure for cancer, as he explains to the protesters. You know, he says, one in five of you will die of cancer. I'm trying to find a cure, so, you know, shut your face, or whatever it was he says. But actually, he's trying to find... What he's really trying to do is find a cure for baldness.
Somehow requires them to blast dogs with radiation to, like, make their hair fall out and then try to regrow the hair on irradiated skin. None of this makes sense. it hilariously doesn't make sense, but, like... So what seems to be the implication here, I should explain, is that this, you know, corrupt doctor is using government funds to pretend to try to cure cancer, but is really researching a cure for baldness at the same time, I guess, is what the implication seems to be. So basically he's just misused. See, this is a film where, like, early on I was trying to figure out, like, what perspective it was coming from. Like, it at first seemed like the animal rights people, like, that this was a film warning about the dangers of using lab animals. And it might still be, but sort of everyone in this movie comes out looking like an idiot and or asshole. At various points it turns into an obvious Jaws ripoff or satire. Like, that's another thing. Like, I'm also looking for the tone of this film. Like, it's not obviously a satire the way Piranha is, or even sort of like a mostly serious film with satirical elements the way Alligator is. Like, it's a film that doesn't seem to know what the hell it is in any given moment.
Yeah, until the giant rats come along. But anyway, so what happens was Dr. Hamilton, who he has an assistant, they inject the serum into some lab rats, and then the activists come in one night, they break in, and they just trash the lab, and they accidentally release the rats, who have now grown to be pretty big. One of the activists gets killed, and the rest escape into the tunnels, numerous tunnels that are under the university rather than college, because this is Canada. And which is funny, by the way. I actually think this film was actually set in the U.S. because there was a scene where a lady was singing the American national anthem. So we have no idea this is Canada, but it was.
I'm assuming the school is supposed to be MIT, which does actually have a network of tunnels underneath the buildings.
It'll be like an MIT type college. We'll call it MIT for now for future reference, but MIT Canada, that's what we'll call it. We got police on the scene who are investigating the dead activist, and we've got exterminators going into the tunnels looking for the rats, and so it's about to blow all up here. Let's stop right there for a second and talk about some of the people involved in this. Let's talk about the director, Damien Lee. He's filmed such notable fare as Abraxas, Guardian of the Universe, starring one Jesse the Body Ventura. he's done Ski School, another fine piece of cinematic art.
To be fair, Ski School was pretty sure immortalized as part of an Always Sunny episode where they parodied 80s sports and collegiate movies. Apparently because Ski School's star, Dean Cameron, was a special guest in that Always Sunny episode.
Yeah. Yeah, so Sonny's pretty funny, but Damien Lee, so that's the pedigree of Food of the Gods 2, with Damien Lee at the helm. We've got two movies like Abraxas and Ski School. Not what you would call Criterion Collection material.
Well, not with that attitude.
We get giant rats killing people, they kill exterminators, they go after the other activists, they try to kill whoever really hunts them down. We've got Zeke, the janitor. That good dude was just creepy acting, wasn't he?
I couldn't tell if he was, like, just a really bad actor or he was trying to do kind of a bored stoner thing, which...
Exactly.
Which seemed to be the case. I mean, he's had that... You know, he looks like old Richard Dreyfuss crossed with Tommy Chong. Like, he's got, like, you know, that weathered old, like, fisherman's hat. Like, I think he was either trying to do stoned or he was really legitimately stoned.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have the actor who played Zeke on my credit listing here. But, a fine performance by the guy who played Zeke. Confusing performance. So. We've got there's a scene in the film where I guess we got a bar, and this young guy named Carlos comes out with his girlfriend, and he's drunk, and he needs to go take a piss in the bushes, and gets attacked by a giant rat. Later on, that's referenced when I think Dr. Hamilton tells the police that. The kid had half his ass chewed off. And that's a direct quote.
We should mention that this is an inornately quotable movie. Just check out the IMDb quote page, because it is extremely long for a movie of this obscurity.
Yes, exactly.
It's quite fantastically quotable. Carlos was also getting in on the bushes with a student who was earlier shown to be hitting on our hero while wearing a Bugs Bunny windbreaker.
Yeah, she's... And I think this leads to a scene where Dr. Hamilton, he has a dream sequence. And this is what I want to talk about. I want to hit on this. He has a dream sequence where he injects himself with the growth serum. And then he and the young female students start to make out, and they start to shed some clothing and get it on. And he starts to grow pretty dang big in the process, which implies, you know where I'm going with this. It kind of implies quite a bit in the middle of a sex scene. You know where I'm going with that. And it ends up being quite horrifying.
It's an obviously an odd moment, but there's a lot of odd moments with it. First of all, that's like the second sex scene we get. The first is with, I mean, we call this student young, but she looks like she's in her her mid-20s at least, and she looks like the same age as his actual love interest, his girlfriend, played by Lisa Schrage from Mary Lou Maloney from Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2.
Yeah.
So, like, and we get a lovemaking scene between between Neil and Mary Lou, but you know, which is of course all like shadows and soft focus, like, you know, that kind of like cheap movie tenderness, but it's intercut with scenes of like the rats eating the food that's going to make them grow. And I don't, like, the whole film has this weird obsession with male virility, and it doesn't, I don't know how it tied in with anything. It's not like, you know, a film about reclaiming male virility like Bubba Hotep is. Right. It's like, you know, clearly, like, they're drawing some connection between like growth serum and like bodily growth and erections and like, you know, frustrated masculinity, because he's got, like, you know, for a professor, he manages to get a hold of a lot of big guns when they're hunting the racks, even before the cops are like really involved. And there's like this weird gun nut exterminator similar to Brad Dourif in Graveyard Shift,
yeah,
who's like got this like modified
flamethrower
that's like super phallic. And you know, there's an obsession with baldness and curing baldness. The rival professor has an obvious toupee. His lab assistant is very quickly balding. Like, the whole thing is like obsessed with, like, not in a like a tied together thematic way, but just has an ongoing like back of the mind fixation with like virility and male growth and strength. And it doesn't, like, that would be awesome if it were tied into a theme here.
Yeah, the I guess the prevalent theme, I guess we'll have to just resort to the prevalent theme of Food of the Gods 2 being just, hey, giant rats. We just pinpoint it down to that. You've got, of course, a movie like this, you can't have a movie that takes place on a college campus without an evil dean.
Who seems to have power over police investigations. I mean, deans don't even really have that much power. Don't really have that much power in real life. They're mostly, like, I mean, colleges have multiple boards, and like, there's no like one guy in charge of a college, is what I'm saying. Like, especially what seems to be a large and very, very heavily funded university with a lot of like innovative scientific research. There's no like one guy who's gonna like be the one telling the science department what they can and can't do about a crisis with their own resources.
Yeah.
And like opening the new pool building, like, there's no one guy doing all that.
So probably the highlight for Dean in terms of conversation, we've had two guys in their cars being attacked by the giant rats. And during the accident or investigation with the police, Dr. Hamilton, Neil, pretty much tells the dean that he can't stop ignoring this problem, because he's been ignoring it up to this point. He doesn't want to evacuate the campus. He wants to proceed with the opening of their big fancy pool. And Dean White is all basically, this is just a car accident, man. What are you talking about? And what does Neil say?
Since when do cars eat your liver?
Yeah, since when do cars eat your liver?
That's the film equivalent of Batista's Basketballs Don't Hold Grudges.
Yeah.
Like, you don't even necessarily need to watch Food of the Gods 2. I would recommend it because it's insane. But, you know, for a good idea of this film, the IMDb quote page is so long for a film like this, and it's like half the script in here.
Yeah. We're talking about Colin Fox as Dr. Delhurst, the guy who's playing around with the animal experimentation. And someone's just been killed, and Dr. Delhurst comes in and says, "I came as fast as I could," and he's looking at them. He's looking, I guess, the giant rat, and he's like, "This is incredible. How did you do this? The possibilities are endless." And someone said, "Hey, your assistant's dead here." And then he says, "Oh, how is the poor boy?" Just told him he's dead, and he said, "How is the poor boy?"
And, you know, Colin Fox has had Delhurst in this. Long and, like, you know, varied career. You know, he's constantly busy. He's done a lot of voice work, and I think most of our listeners would probably be familiar with him from the Legend of Zelda cartoon as the king, and as well as the amazing CDI games. So if you've ever seen people make fun of those on YouTube or put them together in, like, mashups, him saying things like, "Link, my boy!" Like, that is the man here. And he's got, like, at first he starts out as kind of an interestingly, like, complicated figure. Like, he's not really on the level, but he's still a scientist.
Yeah.
By the end of the film, he's just, like, literally dancing around at the thought of making money. Like, he goes from, like, morally gray to scenery-chewing villain so wonderfully.
Yeah. What is it? He says, "Mitosis at the speed of light!" And some other brilliant stuff, but I think his ultimate end is appropriate for him. He takes a sample of the blasted skin on the poor dog who's been laying on that table the whole movie, Joel, suffering. And so he's still there at the end of the movie, and, you know, the doctor takes a sample from the dog and he mixes it with the growth serum, and that's when he starts going, he sees dollar signs, and he accidentally gets some on his finger, and
somehow experienced scientist accidentally breaks the glass slide that's on his microscope when he's trying to take it out, cuts himself, and basically becomes dog cancer.
I mentioned it earlier, he kind of looks like Pizza the Hut for a few minutes there, with cheese oozing off of him. And
like, I was thinking, oh, he does. So he basically turns into, like, a mass of tumors, and, like, I thought, personally, he looked like a meal from RoboCop right before he got creamed by the car, but,
creamed.
That our official go home in the box word for getting struck by a vehicle.
It's creamed.
Thank you, kid from Pet Sematary.
That's right.
But, yeah, so we've got, like, this weird, pretty gross, like, transformation scene, which, you know, was probably not the bulk of the special effects here, because there are a lot of rat puppets.
Yep.
But, and of course they worked with real rats for a lot of scenes, which, or at least, like, the lab scenes before the rats start growing. So, which, of course, is kind of a budgetary drain. But, you know, this is the centerpiece special effect of the film, and for what it is, I mean, you know, the makeup effects in this film mostly are not terribly realistic, but this is a pretty appreciably gross moment.
Yeah. Overall, and you mentioned the special effects, it's not horribly done. It's pretty they're pretty decent. They're not noticeably bad or anything like that, but, you know, of course they've got you got to get the close-ups of the rat puppets biting people, but in terms of the camera tricks and whatnot to make the rats look giant, it's not bad. You know, continue on with some of the plot here. Of course, we mentioned the dean is excited to open their brand new sports pool, and what do they kick the show off with? What exciting event do they kick the show off with for their first event inside their fancy new pool? Is it water polo? No. It's not high diving. It's synchronized swimming.
Yeah. Well, how could you not?
And of course, we get the inevitable scene of the giant rats somehow sneaking their way into the pool without anyone noticing and attacking the team of synchronized swimmers. And all hell breaks loose from there. We've got people running for their lives, much like in The Bees. This is another example of just people running all over the place. And we've got cops busting in. And the cops, man, they're busting in and they're just shooting everywhere. They're not even... They're shooting... people in the crowd are getting shot. And one cop gets knocked over and loses his gun. And some random guy picks it up and starts shooting all over the place. And he's shooting more people. And I think more people got shot than more people got bit by rats. And it just...
That was the rat's plan all along.
Yeah, the growth serum also comes with a high intelligence rate, and so therefore the rats plotted the demise of man by hopefully some maniac with a gun shooting everybody. So we've got the anti-gun stance here in Food of the Gods too. And don't
anti-gun stance? I just thought it was a general God, these people are morons stance.
So of course the pool scene leads to of course the conclusion of the film, which of course luring the rats using the one female lab rat, the white rat, I can't remember the rat's name suddenly.
Louise.
She's taking the Louise who's in heat and turning her into a giant rat and making her lure all the evil giant black rats outside where the cops just shoot them all.
We should say that Louise was our hero's personal pet.
That's right, he was. He was the one rat that he didn't want to experiment on. And unfortunately, he needed her in the end. And it was not, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but what the fuck. You know, Louise does not survive the end of the film. But and what
which is actually really upsetting, because she was like the one character I cared about.
Which we get a scene of Louise jumping through a window. So forget man jumping through window, we get a giant white rat jumping through window, which is almost as good, but unfortunately Louise meets the same demise as all the other rats. And so, what about the ending of Food of the Gods 2 here, Joel? We got
really tied all together.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as the cops are done shooting all the rats, Dr. Neil, you know, heads directly to a payphone, and we watch him throw in each and every coin. He puts in about 3 or 4 coins, and then he's calling from the beginning of the film his colleague Dr. Travis, who tells him, "You need to hurry, Billy. Bobby is getting violent." And of course, they don't show him, but Bobby is now ginormous, and he snaps Dr. Travis's neck and busts out of the place, leaving a big giant Bobby shaped hole in the doorway. And then end credits. So we kind of get nuns. I wonder if they were actually trying to build up to Food of the Gods 3.
I thought that was called Honey, I Blew Up the Kid.
Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. Food of the Gods 3.
Yeah, it's an interesting era to be releasing this film, because this was obviously... It's a sequel to a film that came out 13 years earlier. Food of the Gods 2 was 1989. You know, it's not during an era of a lot of killer animal flicks that I know of. You know, it's before, like, Jurassic Park came out, so we didn't have that... moment where speculative science involving big monsters was big again. It's just a really weirdly placed film. I'm almost tempted to think that, like, they were trying to do, like, a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids ripoff, and then just, like, stumbled into, oh, we got the Food of the Gods rights.
Yeah, because, of course, it has no bearing at all, no tie-in or anything to the original Food of the Gods, which I believe is 76. All right, I knew it was the 70s. But yeah, I guess Carol Co. or whichever company earned the rights to Food of the Gods, and I guess they needed to utilize those rights by naming this Food of the Gods too, but didn't really no connection to the original. And so this is more, it feels more like a standalone film anyway, and it seems like something that they were possibly thinking of a sequel for with the ending that we got, or it just could have been that they're like, fuck it, we ran out of film, we're done, you know.
Let's just do a big weird ending. I mean, you know, that's an awfully big through line in that film, the, like, you know, young Bobby grown huge, that we don't really get, like, it's tied into the plot, of course, it's just like, it doesn't really intersect at the end like you'd expect, so it must be some kind of sequel hook. I was kind of hoping, like, we'd get Big Bobby against, like, the rats.
Yo, no, maybe, I thought maybe we were going to get Giant Bobby sides with the rats, and we'd get, like, some sort of giant, like, Willards or something.
Giant Willard! with a big throne. Like, and an army of rats. Oh, actually, that'd be a great ending. I'm in.
Yeah.
But we don't really get any of that. It's just I would love some kind of explanation for how this film came into being, because it seems so random to exist.
Yeah. So overall, your impressions of Food of the Gods 2, Joel?
I mean, it's, you know, the quotes page says it all. It's just full of morons running in completely the wrong direction to solve a problem they don't seem to comprehend at all. It's amazing. it's definitely like, if you're in the mood for something completely inexplicable,
yep.
And it's what the hell? It's right. Just. It is what it is. It's amazing, and you know, it's the main actor comes from Chopping Mall, and you know, Mary Lou is there for some reason, and she doesn't really get to do anything, but hey, what the hell, she's there, and the King from Legend of Zelda is there. It's just, I don't know how this came together. I don't know why as much as I love this film, I would just love an explanation for how Food of the Gods 2 happened.
Yeah, I think, and by the same token, I enjoyed the film. This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a great movie, but it's done so, there's a lot of energy in this film, for one thing, so it's never dull, it's never boring. There's always something to either laugh at or be amazed at, and you know, everyone loves giant, vicious-looking puppets being thrown at actors, and so we get a lot of that in this movie. And I think I can go ahead and safely recommend Food of the Gods 2, as especially if you're you know, looking for just to be entertained, because that's all this basically is. It's just one big entertaining film. There's not really a whole lot to say. Like Joel, like you mentioned earlier, we don't know if there's like an underlying theme that they're trying to convey here with animal rights and whatnot, but it doesn't matter, because the movie, once you get past all that, the movie's just a rousing entertainment. From beginning to end. And so, yeah. Check out Food of the Gods 2. With that said, Joel, the two movies we talked about on this edition of Go Home in the Box, The Bees and Food of the Gods 2, can't be considered, in the more mainstream terms of a quote-unquote good movie. And so, you know, you're going to get a lot of people who, you know, let's say, humor me here and say we've got, you know, video stores are still in existence, and we've got these movies on the shelves. You know, there's a segment of people that would totally ignore these films for whatever reason, and they're missing out on a good time. Or maybe perhaps someone knows someone who has seen these films and mock them for it. You know what I'm saying? How could you sit through something like that? That movie's garbage, blah, blah, blah. I get a lot of that myself. And so, one of the things I wanted to rant on real quick is something I termed movie snobbery. This isn't really a defense of, you know, the kind of movies that I watch, because I watch good films, I watch bad films, I watch, you know, stuff in between as well. I just, a wide-ranging taste of films on my own end here, and I really think there are people out there who will, they'll ask, well, who's in the film? And if they haven't heard of it, they'll write it off. You'll give someone a title of a film that you just watched, and they'll be like, what's that? I've never heard of that. I wouldn't see that. I've never heard of it. Yeah, you know, you hear that. I heard that quite often, you know, even back in the day of being back in the video store and browsing the shelves. You know, friends would be like, I've never heard of that. I don't want to see that. And so, I mean, I don't know if it's intentional snobbery or not, but I really just, it just turns me off. Because film is, it is an art form, whether there's different degrees of the level of skill in most cases, but just to shun a movie because you haven't heard of it or because you don't know who's in it, just there's a lot of stuff that doesn't get seen because of that attitude. And not giving, I'm not saying give every movie a chance, but you know, when you're getting a recommendation from a friend or whatnot, you know, do your friend a service and just check the movie out based on their recommendation, because you never know what you find. You could find the greatest movie of all time. And I think I really think in movies in this case, like The Bees and Nah, that stuff needs to be seen, because I would want to share movies like this with friends, you know, because it's just an enjoyable, good time. And you know, I've done that in the past, and people are like, "Hey, man, thanks for pulling that movie out, because that was awesome. I enjoyed it." And so they would recommend it to their friends and so on. And that's always cool to see when something like that happens. So I really think, you know, more of like, I would like for people to give more lesser seen or lesser known films a chance, because it really, it's really doing a disservice to yourself for not really partaking in the experience. And so that's basically my rant, is just, hey man, just chill out and just, you know, watch a movie, take a chance, take a dive into something you may not have heard of and not familiar with, because it just might be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I agree, because my whole deal is checking out films that are obscure, films that are oddities, and, you know, that's not obviously every component to my taste. I love plenty of films that are well-known. I love, you know, my favorite film is not a horror film. It's not, like, a cult film. It's, you know, Late Spring. You know, I just think there's value in having a really wide-ranging experience with film if you're interested in film. I mean, you know, this goes into a lot of what we talked about last week with, like, film criticism online becoming kind of a team sport, in the way people back certain franchises, and the way, you know, allowing Netflix or big corporations to sort of curate your experiences with film is just doing yourself a disservice, because your choices are inevitably limited by taking that task. I mean, obviously, like, this is an argument we're making on a day we're intentionally talking about, you know, bad movies. We're talking about turkeys, but
leftover turkey. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think there's value in that kind of thing too. I mean, one of the reasons I love The Bees so much is that gap between the intentions of the film and the sort of what they achieve with the film is really poignant to me, in the way that it is for something like Ed Wood or Manos, or, you know, any film where there's some really lofty ideas going in or lofty intentions, and the resources just aren't there to support that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's meant to be where the filmmaker really cares, but it's meant to be a quickie to make money, things like that. I mean, you know, in the sort of inverse, that's why I think for a lot of people, Oscar bait films or big Hollywood message films feel so phony at times, because all the resources are available, all the money, all the talent, but the ideas are often very simplistic and very pat, like the conclusions are very simple. So that's the and there's a sense of complacency even when talking about something, you know, that obviously requires some level of urgency, requires some level of, you know, would usually require some level of anger, whether it be, you know, poverty or war, atrocity, or anything that affects a large number of people in a really tragic manner. These films are so self-satisfied that it's easy to be turned off the message itself. I mean, what I love about independent film, about, you know, B movies, is that there's, for a lot of them, and not to say that there can't be lazy ones, because obviously there are tons of lazy ones,
Yeah. But
a lot of them, there's a real hunger in these films, whether it's like a hunger for a certain topic. Like, obviously The Bees was really passionate about environmentalism, even if it wasn't a really well thought out film. But for a lot of these films, there's a real passion for just like making a film, which I love, and which a lot of like big films don't have. I mean, you know, and that's, you know, not a new observation or a new like phenomenon, because it's easy to be complacent when you're in a secure spot. Like, that's not unique to film. But I think the best like antidote to that is to not be complacent as a film goer or an audience member, or, you know, someone who's passionate about film or interested in, even if you're not like actively like engaged in criticism or commentary online, like, you know, a podcast or even like reviews on Letterboxd or IMDb or whatever, like, even if you're not doing those things, like, you can still be an engaged viewer. And, you know, that kind of complacency you even see from engaged viewers. Like, I'm a big fan of Red Letter Media's work and Half in the Bag, like all their videos, but, you know, I'm still kind of miffed at their, God, what a weak lame word that is, miffed. I say annoyed and irritated so often that I didn't want to come across as constantly annoyed or irritated, but I so often am. No, I was kind of annoyed at the way they did, you know, a Half in the Bag episode talking about the new release of Stephen King's, as well as the 1990 Tommy Lee Wallace directed one with Tim Curry, and they were kind of amazed at the response to the original one. They talk about in the video that people have such strong feelings for that film when they just looked at it as this old goofy thing.
Yeah.
And but they never seem to, like, when they talk about the film, they never seem to really incorporate that sort of acknowledgement into their response to the film. Like, there never seems to be that moment where, like, look, people's your taste, your perceptions of something you're watching are not a democracy. Like, you don't have to, like, adhere to how other people feel about something. But, you know, they seem to never have asked themselves watching the film, well, what about this was the part that really got people passionate? Because I look at it and I see an old goofy sort of ridiculous and ragged, like, overlong weird thing. Like, they didn't really know how to grapple with it, and it comes through their commentary, and it leads to a certain sort of condescension where it's like, it's kind of rich coming from two guys that, like, have spent their adult lives fixated on Star Wars and Star Trek and things like that. It's like, but those are more socially acceptable. I mean, obviously, like, among horror fans, like longtime horror fans, the horror community, like it is sort of not really a sacred object in the way that like Halloween is, but
yeah.
You know, it's a really well-regarded film, or at least Tim Curry's Pennywise is a really beloved performance. You know, I think like obviously you don't have to alter your opinion of a film based on what fans it has, but I'm always interested in people's responses to film and like why they respond a certain way, even to stuff I don't particularly like or find anything in. I mean, you know, in some cases it's really easy, like it's really simplistic, like, you know, you're a white person and you watch This Is Us because you're a white person and you're watching This Is Us. Like, sometimes people really are that boring. But when you've got something that's kind of a weird, ragged, and strange movie, and it is definitely that, the book is definitely that, and honestly, Star Wars is definitely that if you look at it in the with a perspective that's not informed by how much pop cultural osmosis there is for Star Wars. I mean, it's everything in Star Wars seems obvious to us because it's so integrated into pop culture.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not that, like, there's a lot of weirdness in that film. I wish it was weirder, actually. So there's a lot of stuff in that film that must have been extremely weird in 1977. So I don't know. I guess what I'm mostly just arguing is when you look at a film, don't just passively look at it. And yeah, we're all guilty of that. So at some points, whether we just don't have the energy to be anything but just like entertained, which is fine because everyone's in the mood for that sometimes. But like, you know, I think like being an active, energetic, and engaged viewer of film, like, it's only going to increase your appreciation and your willingness to try new films. And anything like that, you know, pushes back even just a little bit against the corporate control of one of our greatest arts. I mean, that's a long, slow-going process to fight against that, but, you know, it's got to happen, or else we're going to be left with nothing but Marvel movies to watch for the rest of our lives.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, right now we're in. I mean, you know, quick question, Chris. Have you been on Facebook lately?
Yes, I have.
What's the one thing everyone's like posting about?
I see a lot of Justice League.
Oh well, I mean, I was talking about. I actually haven't seen too much of that. We might have friends with different levels of enthusiasm for Justice League, but I was talking about net neutrality.
Oh, net neutrality. Yeah, I haven't seen a whole lot of that on my own personal feed, but
I have a lot of like very granola friends,
yeah,
who are like really like who are like, you know, sort of classic whiny liberal types.
Yeah, there's more. I see more of that too on the different websites that I visit.
There's a lot of that.
They'll have a little note at the top of their page about the notice about net neutrality, and so I see a lot of that more on the outside Facebook. So I mean,
I've also got a lot of friends who like have podcasts and like blogs too. So I think among people who are actively using the internet as like either a side business or part of their main career, it's probably a bigger concern.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
but yeah. I mean, the more culturally engaged you are, even something like film, which, you know, I mean, obviously can just be entertainment if that's what you want to be. But like, the more involved you are in, like, in our art culture, the more engaged you are in like people's responses to it, like probably the more interested you're going to be in like in the way our mass communication is controlled, or the way it's structured, the way it's priced, the way it's sold, just anything that involves the way we manage to get and disseminate information. Like, you know, I see, not to get too highfalutin, but I see, like, I see people's response to film and the way they talk about film has an extension of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. You know, there's a the level of engagement kind of varies, but I do see I do see a correlation between the level of engagement, especially online, and what side of the I don't want to go too deep into this rabbit hole, but what side of the political fence you lean on also. I think it's just in terms of movies, though, I guess my whole end of things is you browse TV, you browse through the channels, especially movie channels, and you always see the same old movies on there. Just AMC is always playing Ghostbusters or Lord of the Rings on TNT or some shit like that. And there's just like a genre, well, maybe not a subgenre, but there's certain films within each genre that they get neglected over time. And so the reason why I started this whole rant was because try to keep the spirit of the era that those films came out in alive. You know, just like, I think with me it's more of a nostalgia thing. I think where I remember watching this movie back in like 1980 or 90, whatever, and wanting to share that nostalgia, share that moment with other people, but having others reject it because either A, they call it an quote unquote an old movie, or B, it's a movie that they never heard of before. And those are the same people that are doing things like jumping on Netflix and binge watching The Punisher or Stranger Things, or spending really dialed into, I guess, the corporate curation, as you wanted to put it. And so it's just kind of kind of annoyance on my part when I see that.
See, I'm here all getting all like Noam Chomsky, and you're all heart. Like, this is why it works, because I don't have one. And
you've got it was chewed out by giant lab rats.
You know, it was for the best. that's a totally valid concern. I mean, like, with culture, like, I think it really comes down to, like, it comes down to, if you don't exert ownership of your own culture, then people with more money and resources are going to do that to you, and then you're not going to be left with anything to call your own or any options to make or distribute your own.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm probably coming from a hopeful creator's place of concern, but yeah, I mean, part of that is like the ability to share culture, which of course has a lot to do with like our copyright law, but also just with like the accessibility of the culture you want to share with someone. I mean, it's a lot harder to share a favorite movie if like you can't get a copy of it. Like, I would love to tell people every day about Gregory's Girl or Brother from Another Planet, but I don't have any assurance that they're going to be able to actually track down a DVD or even like, you know, find it on a streaming site to actually be able to watch the damn thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and that was the whole point of Go Home in the Box also, Joel, was to kind of like enlighten the masses on some of these films that we're talking about, because not all of these films are going to be great, but if we're talking about them, it's because we find some type of reference point that really hits home, that we want to hammer home, and you know, inform people about. Also, we want to tell people about movies that we've enjoyed that they probably need to see. You know what I mean? And that was the whole concept of this podcast to begin with, was to shed some light on exactly the type of movies that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the whole impetus for, like, online criticism, which is, you know, always a shame that a lot of it ends up being so... Of course, it's true of anything, that everything, that, like, you know, not everything in any genre is going to be, like, at the apex of what that genre is capable of. I mean, I'm not saying we are, but, like, you know, online criticism is a great way just for people to share their movie experiences or their experiences with any art and, like, connect people through movies. And when it's just, like, an echo chamber of people saying, hey, did you like Thor Ragnarok? Yeah! Awesome! We all like Thor Ragnarok!
Yeah.
Like, it feels less like a fun discussion and more like a checklist of things we all, like, thought tolerable enough to not leave the theater.
Yeah, so, I mean, but in the end, hopefully, Joel, we will continue to provide that input or impart that knowledge that we think we have anyway on some of this stuff. So, so in closing, you know, on my end of things, just, you know, take a chance on a movie at least once that you haven't heard of or you haven't seen, see if you like it. That's basically my beef.
Yeah, no, I mean, totally, just, like, you know, give something a chance that hasn't been specifically marketed to you.
Exactly. And so with that in mind, I think that's a great discussion point to close the show on there, Joel. Excellent discussion, talking about the bees and Nah, Food of the Gods 2, and then, of course, our little serious discussion there at the end, which is always good. We always need to let some steam off at the end. So, for Joel LaPuma, I'm Chris Jordan. We make podcasts good. You listen. You listen good. Thank you. See you.